The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Well, it's no secret today that it's getting harder for many retirees to maintain a standard of living. Things have changed in the last decade. Stock market returns aren't where they used to be. Interest rates are much lower, and even part of Social Security benefits have been reduced. So what do retirees do? Do they stay in the market and take the risk, or are there alternatives? Joining me on the program is Professor Wade Fow from American College. And Professor, let's talk about the retirement tools that people have today, because traditionally, when you take a look at retirement, there's almost two schools of thought in the financial industry. There's one that stresses probability-based, or let's say market-type returns as the best solution for retirement. The other side of the industry comes from safety first, and that's the insurance industry that's saying, no, you're in retirement, you can't afford to take the risk, you're better off securing your income than you are making bets in the market. Let's talk about those two philosophies and how maybe sometimes the better approach is a combination of them.
Right. So the two philosophies, really, from the investment side, there's more of this focus on the idea that stocks outperform bonds over the long term. And that long term is short enough that individuals can really take advantage of that. So they're really focused on the upside growth potential of an aggressive investment portfolio. And on the insurance side, the focus is more on the idea of pooling the risk, and rather than having to bear all the risk. There's so many retirement risks that change once you enter retirement compared to pre-retirement. The longevity, not knowing how long to plan for, the market volatility that gets amplified when you're taking distributions from your investments. And rather than trying to manage all that risk on your own, which really requires being overly conservative with your spending, instead you should pool that risk and rely on some of the subsidization of essentially those who don't live as long, subsidize those who live longer, and that can allow everyone to really enjoy more spending over their lifetime. And so it's that belief that the stock market's going to outperform versus a belief that you can't really rely on stock market outperformance, that risk really gets amplified more in retirement and you should pull some of that risk.
You know, one of the common tools that we've used in the industry is withdrawal rates. And you and I have talked about this, what really works today, 3% or the 4% rule. And there's a problem with that because typically what happens, let's say you have a pool of assets. Let's just make this easy and say you have $1 million and that's invested half in stocks and half in bonds or some combination. And so you need $40,000 a year to supplement your income. So you're taking out $40,000 a year out of your investments. Now, a lot of people will be selling off shares of mutual funds. Let's talk about the sequence risk of what happens. For example, let's say you decided to retire January 1, 2008, and now you're drawing down 4% of your assets in probably one of the worst bear markets that we had since the beginning of the decade.
Right. And so it's not just if you consider, say, for example, someone will be planning for a 30-year retirement. They can't rely on what's the average market return going to be over the next 30 years. That kind of approach really only works if you're investing a fixed amount and leaving it alone in the market for 30 years. If you're adding new savings over time, there's a sequence of returns risk. The returns later on at the end of your career will matter more. But if you're taking distributions, there's sequence risk that gets even more amplified, and it's the returns early on that matter the most. And it's just simply this idea that if the market declines, you have to sell more shares to meet your spending goal. And then even if the market subsequently recovers, your portfolio is not going to get to enjoy that full recovery because there's less left to recover, and you really can be left in a worse position. And that's that sequence risk that amplifies investment volatility, really front loads the risk to the beginning of retirement. And even though you may have a 30-year retirement, if you don't get decent market returns in the first 5 or 10 years, it doesn't matter how good things get later on. You're really not going to be able to sustain a high spending level over that retirement period.
Now, you've done a number of research when it comes to retirement portfolios. In contrary to what most people would think, in other words, just as we were talking there about sequence risk, when you first retire, you cannot afford to have a huge drawdown as a result of a bear market. The last one, the average stock in the S&P was down 45%. So you want to be as safe as possible. So you're going to probably have more safer investments up front. But given the end of your retirement, let's say an average retirement span of 25 years, you should have more in equities. That's almost the opposite of what most people would think.
Yeah, I think it's important to take less risk when you're the most vulnerable to the impacts of risk. And that can really be when you have the most wealth, where a given drop in the market can have the biggest impact on your total wealth holdings. So I do think having less risk around the retirement date is important. And if you are following some safety first type strategies where you build in a more secure floor to cover your basics or your lifestyle, that if you're not in a worst case scenario market environment, so that if markets do end up doing fine for you, just a natural outcome will be that your stock allocation as a portion of your total assets would tend to gravitate upwards throughout your retirement. That's just going to be a natural implication. But then that can also reduce some of the downside risk, taking away some of the risk right around the retirement date when you're most vulnerable to losing wealth.
Professor, why do you think that annuities have gotten such a bad rap? Because, you know, most people, let's say our parents that worked for companies, let's say they spent 25, 30 years, they worked at GM or some large American corporation, they got a pension when they retired. Most people don't realize what they got was really an annuity. The company, it could have been IBM or GM, put aside money for that person's retirement. When they got to retirement age, they went to an insurance company and they said, all right, the employee is age 65, his wife is age X, what can you give them for the rest of their life based on this pot of money? And then, of course, companies did away with those defined benefit pension plans, but aren't annuities the same kind of thing? Why do you think annuities have gotten such a bad rap?
Well, I think it's partly the insurance industry's fault that the very basic idea of an annuity, an income annuity, where you exchange a lump sum amount for an income for life, you're exactly right. That's what a defined benefit pension is. That's what Social Security is. But no one really has any incentive to sell those. The traditional investment managers don't want to lose assets to those. And also, like commission-based insurance agents don't generally focus on income annuities because they are very low commission products. And the insurance industry has developed a lot more complex types of annuities that represent most of the annuity sales and have higher commissions, so they're more attractive for salespeople to sell. But yeah, it's only the academics out there that really love income annuities and say over and over how these can really contribute to helping with longevity risk. And that I've even doing simulations, it's hard for upside growth potential from an investment portfolio to really outperform the mortality credit, the subsidy you get from having an income annuity when you live beyond your life expectancy. You're getting this unique source of returns. You're getting a payment based on living to your life expectancy. And then when you live beyond that, you're getting returns from those who didn't live as long. And it's hard for an investment portfolio to overcome that. So it really is a very attractive, even from an investment perspective, a really attractive option for retirement income. It can allow for ultimately a larger legacy. But people just have this bad idea about annuities. They're not willing to consider it. I think they partly don't look at liquidity in the right way. They say with an investment portfolio, I have all this liquidity. I lose that liquidity with an annuity. But they're not really reflecting on the fact that they have to cover their spending goal for life. And that means most of their investment assets may not really be liquid in the sense that if they did spend them for something else, then they're gone. They're not there to cover that future spending goal. And I think if you look at what's true liquidity, what do you have left after you've covered all your spending goals? A lot of times an income annuity can meet the spending goals more cheaply, leaving more truly discretionary liquid assets available to be invested for more enjoyment or for legacy or whatever that case may be.
You know, it's really amazing, too, because we've done studies. We ran a Bloomberg study on the S&P, and from January 1st 2000 till April 1st, 2013, the stock market was up 8.9%, or an annual return with dividends reinvested of only 2.5%. Now, given in the year 2000 that we had just come off a multi-decade bull market, where, in fact, the last 5 years of that bull market, stocks were going up double digits every year, who would have thought, looking out 13 years, that the returns would be this low? That would be number one. Or number two, let's say, Professor, that you put half your portfolio in, let's say, a bond fund. In the year 2000, if you were in a bond fund, you were getting 8%. I mean, you're lucky if you get 3% today. So, you know, the average bond fund over the last 5 years has cut their dividends at an annual rate of over 5%.
Right. We are in this very low interest rate world. And Robert Shiller's talked a lot about the cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio, a way to try to smooth out some of the earnings volatility from market valuations. And that reached an all-time high in 2000. So that certainly suggested we would have lower returns subsequently, although people who just focused on the last few years would not have seen that coming, because, as you mentioned, the late 1990s was an amazing period for stock market performance. But we're still in an overvalued market environment based on Robert Shiller's cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio. And so we have low interest rates, we have overvalued stock markets. It really means that looking forward from today, retirees need to be at least planning on the possibility that returns will be lower than they've been historically over the long historical period in the U.S.
You know, McKinsey and Company just came out with a study this week, and they're estimating returns of about 4% for the stock market for exactly the thing you just mentioned, overvaluations. Periods of high valuations are always accompanied and followed by periods of low valuations, which means lower returns. So it's not just lower returns in the stock market, Professor. Unfortunately, in the past, if the stock market was getting pricey, if things were getting risky, and usually towards the end of a bear market, the Federal Reserve was raising interest rates. Well, you know, the Fed has had a difficult time just raising interest rates a quarter of a point. But the point I'm making here is, in the past, you could always go to the bond market. You could say, okay, stocks are getting risky, they're getting overvalued, I'll go over to the bond market and I'll get a higher return. You could have got 5 or 6% back in 2007. There's no way you could get that today. In fact, you have almost just the reverse. Almost a third of the sovereign bonds around the globe are negative.
You're absolutely right that after periods where stock markets have done very well, we would expect interest rates to be higher, which then if there's a market decline, that would be offset partly by falling interest rates and starting from higher interest rates to begin with, bigger returns on bond portfolios. But that's not really all that feasible in today's environment, where we have a 10-year treasury in the neighborhood of 1.8%. There's not really all that much further it can fall. And with that low starting point, it's not going to be able to offer the kinds of returns really that are needed to even meet something like the traditional 4% spending rule for retirement. It requires spending above what the bond yield curve can support to even spend at a 4% distribution rate. And then you're relying more and more in doing that on getting outsized stock market returns, which could happen. It could still work, but it's nowhere near as safe as I think a lot of people have gotten the idea that if they retire and use a 4% spending rate, they'll have a 95 or 100% chance for retirement success. And that's just not true. It can't be mathematically true in this kind of low interest rate world where it requires a spending down principal just to be able to meet that spending goal.
You know, one of the problems, though, is a lot of industry software today uses these kind of assumptions when you're forecasting or doing a retirement plan. You're looking at an extended period of time of a drawdown, and there's a sort of implicit assumptions that are being made about these returns, in many cases explicit assumptions about these returns that are used in these plans that are based on historical figures, which, as we know, we're dealing in a different market environment today.
Right. That's one of my biggest pet peeves, that if you do plug in historical averages, which means something like an intermediate term government bond historically was getting 5.5% type returns, that's really just not mathematically possible today. But that's what gets plugged into a lot of the financial planning software. And with those historical averages, it does give you like a 95% chance for success for the 4% rule. but it's not mathematically feasible to get those kinds of returns. And the argument in favor of doing that is, well, just trying to say, who can predict what's going to happen in the future? The best we can do is plug in the historical averages. Well, for bonds, you can predict bond returns. There, if you hold a bond to maturity, its return is going to be its yield. And then if you sell it before maturity, you could have a capital gain or capital loss, but it's going to be centered around today's yield. And it's just not realistic to get historically higher bond returns when you start from such a low level. And so that's one of my biggest pet peeves about a lot of the existing financial planning software out there. It really puts advisors in a tough situation as well, because if a individual is looking at two different advisory firms and one firm tells them, oh, your plan will have a 99% chance for success, the other firm tells them, you know, you only have an 80% chance for success, that individual is naturally going to think that it's just the 99% chance for success, that's a more competent advisor that knows what they're doing, that has got things figured out, when the reality is that's the incompetent advisor who's using unrealistic assumptions and probably doesn't even realize it, and that plan's really not going to work the way that those two parties believe it will.
Yeah, that's one of the problems sometimes, and very competitive in the industry. You go to one person, as you mentioned, and their plan says you only have maybe a 60, 70, 80% chance of success. And you go to somebody else and they say, well, my plan will give you a 90, 95%. And you don't realize it's the assumptions that are being used in the plan that may be totally faulty and could lead to distortions and problems down the road.
Yeah, it's not that advisor with the higher chance for success is a better advisor. It's just that they're using unrealistic assumptions that they probably don't even understand.
So given this nature, let's talk about bonds, because some people say, well, you know, it's cheaper. Why not put a bond portfolio together? Let's say you put a laddered bond portfolio together where you have maturities from a couple of years all the way out to 5, 10, or 15 years. The problem I have with that, Professor, is once again, going back to the year 2000, if you would have known in the year 2000 that interest rates would get down to zero or negative, you would have gone with 20 and 30-year bonds and locked that in. But nobody knew that. So if you had a laddered bond portfolio as they were coming due, some of those bonds were reinvested at a lower interest rate.
Right. Well, for retirement, I usually think of bond ladders more from the perspective of when the bond matures, you're not going to reinvest it. That's actually the spending you want for that year. Yeah, if you are simply just building a bond ladder that you're going to roll over and keep reinvesting, then it is a different type of environment. When somebody's retired, that may be a less common type of situation to see them rolling over bond ladders. But I would agree with your point that that is one of the big risks of rolling over a bond ladder, is the reinvestment risk of not knowing what interest rates will be in the future and then not knowing what kind of returns you'll get when you reinvest those bonds.
Professor, what about a combination? Because we all know that it's important to diversify your portfolio because it reduces risk, and some things do better in certain market environments or economic environments. I think it's the same approach when it comes to investing. So I know you have done studies where you've done laddered bonds or bonds and stocks, and you've done studies with annuities and with stocks. In the different combinations that you have looked at, what have you found to be the most effective?
Well, really, the punchline of that is the way the math works out. You really don't need bond funds in retirement. It's basically, instead of thinking in terms of a stock and bond portfolio, it's a stock and income annuity portfolio. That the income annuity is really a type of bond fund. The insurance company is investing those assets in bonds, so it's getting the kind of returns you expect from a bond portfolio. But then it has this additional overlay of providing the income for precisely the amount of time that it's needed, which is how long that individual lives. And so it's a bond fund that's really matched to what the individual needs. And that allows it to be much more effective in retirement. And so you're getting that income not from the bonds, but from the income annuity, and then you're getting your upside growth potential from the stocks. So stocks plus income annuities is, I think, a great starting point to think about the retirement income problem.
So when you take a look at this, when I look at an income annuity, and you're right, they're not very popular with the financial world because they don't pay high commissions as the more complex products. but they provide what used to be provided decades ago, which were a defined benefit pension plan. You know, to me, I look as an immediate annuity as your own private pension plan.
Right. And that's exactly what it is. It is a pension. The fact that we have these two different words, there's not really a meaningful distinction between the word pension and annuity in the context of when both, although we have many other kinds of annuities now, but from the idea of providing an income for life, that's what a defined benefit pension did, and that's what an annuity does.
In today's environment, where we have a number of things going on, number one, some of the benefits of Social Security were reduced with the law that was passed last November. We've seen defined benefit pension plans go away. We've seen market returns be reduced, whether it's interest rates or the stock market. Wouldn't you recommend, if somebody is having difficulty, that they explore this option? Because to me, you know, it's either that or maybe it's you have to work longer or postpone retirement to a later age, or maybe you work part-time in retirement. But it seems like it's one tool that's available to individuals that they should explore, especially if they're looking for safety first and want that security, especially after going through two bear markets.
Right. It's an expensive time to retire in general. It's just because of this low interest rate world. And it's also a time when people are forced to take on more and more of the responsibility. With the traditional pension, it was the employer that was telling you the defined benefit. Your pension was going to be based on, well, they'll have a formula, like the number of years you worked and your ending salary, whatever the formula is. But it was then the firm, the employer, that was taking all the market risk to invest those assets. And now we're in this defined contribution world where the individuals are having to take on all that risk on their own and facing lower market returns. So that is a challenging time. It's really a time where people need to get some advice or assistance on how to really approach this and be able to put together a plan that can be expected to work.
Professor, if somebody was looking at an annuity as part of a, let's say, immediate annuity as part of their retirement solution, what things would you advise them to look for to make sure that it was the right type of annuity, it was a right fit for themselves? What would be the most important things? Let's say, for example, if you were retired and considering the same thing for yourself.
Well, you definitely want to look at the credit quality of the insurance company providing the annuity. You don't necessarily want to go with the firm that offers the highest payout rate. You really want to look at credit quality as well, and also look at each state will have a state guarantee association and what's the amount that can be covered by that. And then beyond that point, there are some different features to think about with the annuity. When do you want the income to start? Do you want right away, or do you want to lock in the premium now but have the income start a few years later, or 5 or 10 or even 20 years later is an option? Do you want to have a cost of living adjustment built into it, or do you just want the amount to stay fixed over time without any sort of upward adjustments? One of the risks of annuities is the idea of getting hit by the bus, that you sign the contract, pay the premium, leave the office, and get run over by a bus, and then your heirs are obviously in a bad situation. If that's the kind of risk that really worries you, there are provisions to either have a cash refund that if you die early, your heirs would be refunded any of your premium that had not been paid back as a payment, or to have at least a 10-year period certain where the income will continue for at least 10 years, no matter whether the person's still living or not. So there's those kinds of provisions. I think that's really the key provisions to think about in the world of the basic income annuity, a single premium immediate annuity or deferred income annuity, which are the cousins of the income annuity family.
As we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, you publish a lot of articles when it comes to retirement income, being a specialist in this area. How could they find out more?
My personal website is retirementresearcher.com. It's all one word, just retirementresearcher.com.
Professor, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. You have yourself a great weekend and come back and talk to us again.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure. Happy to be part of the show.
You know, coming out of this discussion you had with Wade Fowle, one of the things I just like whenever you're working on whatever the project has to be is lots of options, you know, options, options, options. And then you see how well you can put them together and make them work.
You know, you got to think outside the box today, because we're really living in a different environment. Gone are the days where we had a lot of security. And if there's one thing I hope you come out of this knowing, is you do have options today, but those options are going to be much different. And secondly, the responsibility for your retirement is really shifting more to you, the retiree. Governments are doing it. We're seeing it with Social Security and Medicare. Companies have already done it with pension plans. And then also, we've seen the returns in the market. So you really need to do some planning here, folks, because, you know, the statistics are coming out. You see studies all the time. McKinsey just came out with a study this week saying that stock market returns based on what is going on in the economy, all the things that you're seeing, that stock market returns over the next decade are going to be 4%. Now, that's better than zero. But folks, the days of double-digit returns each year, like a lot of these financial planning softwares use, where it's 10% return for the market, 6-7% in bonds. Heck, CalPERS is still using 8% assumptions, which are faulty. So the responsibility is basically shifting to you, the individual. But the important thing is, put together a plan. You have options. There's all kinds of alternatives that you have available to you. Well, that just about ends today's program. We went a little long, but I really wanted to get this in because we're seeing more and more cases, John, where individuals are just, they're almost starting to get to the panic point now because interest rates haven't gone up. Their cost of living has gone up. They're seeing benefits. I don't care if they're paying more for Medicare or Social Security increases aren't what they used to be. It's a different situation. So that's why we wanted to take that time today. Well, since we are out of time, I'd like to thank you for joining us on this week's Lifetime Income. Hope you enjoyed the program. We have a lot more programs coming up that I think you'll find of interest in the future. But in the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you, and we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.